You're listening to Taps Family Radio, where the weird is normal. When the strange becomes reality, when the light becomes dark, when you open your eyes and the monsters are still there, that's when you want your family. Welcome to the safest place in the paranormal world, Taps Family Radio. They're the family you always wish you had. Your hosts tonight are Tim Ellis of the Upper Peninsula Paranormal Research Society of Michigan and Chris Perkins of the Atlantic Paranormal Society, interviewing the biggest names and tackling the subjects you want to hear about only on Jackalope Radio. They're not your average family, but I guess that's what makes them fun. Here is Chris and Tim.
And good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome back to another edition of Taps Family Radio on this Tuesday evening. It is 6 o'clock on the East Coast, 5 o'clock Central, and so on and so forth. Good evening, my friends. It is Tim Ellis with you along with, we welcome her back. She was unable to be with us last week, but she's back now, Ms. Chris Perkins. Hello, Chris.
Hey, Tim. How are you?
I'm doing wonderful, and it's not that Larry did not do a fantastic job. He did, but it just kind of sweetens the place up a little bit when you're back, so we appreciate you being here.
Oh, shucks. I always miss it when I'm gone. But, you know, it's going to be great having Larry around to do our mailbag. He's fun, and he's going to be great answering the questions, so he's going to be a nice addition.
He is, and we're kind of talking about that last week in our show that Larry, we don't have Larry the cable guy. We have Larry the mail guy.
That'll work.
Yes, that works, and Larry will be stepping in. He'll be delivering the mail to our show each week, and he'll be coming in with the mail questions and reading them to us and helping us answer them. So we do appreciate that. Thank you very much, Larry. So, Chris, I don't know. Did you want to talk? Did you want to mention right now kind of what was going on last week, why you couldn't be with us, or do you want to talk about that later in the show? We really didn't have a chance to talk about that.
This past weekend?
Yes.
Oh, wow. Just do me a favor. Don't pinch me. I don't want to wake up yet. This last weekend, we were in Radford, Virginia with our very first TAPS Academy lecture. And Tim, I could not have asked for it to go better.
Yeah. Isn't that a great feeling?
We left going, really? It went this well? And we had a lot of help. You know, I just have to just, you know, acknowledge some of those people. The entire Virginia Paranormal Society team was a big help. St. Albans has a wonderful group that helps them, and they were just so, I mean, everybody pitched in. We had Deanna Kelly Said there. You know, we've had her on our show before.
Right.
And you know, we've just had such good feedback. We had two ladies that drove all the way from Galveston, Texas, to Virginia.
Wow.
Yeah, can you imagine?
How far of a drive was that for them?
Well, it was funny. It was a 2-day drive, but part of that was because they somehow managed to go through Louisiana 2 or 3 times. I don't know what happened there, but it was a girls' trip, and they made a few wrong turns. But it was 2 days there, 2 days back, and we heard from her since, and she said every minute of that was worth it. She was just so impressed and pleased with how everything went. So
the first official TAPS Academy was up and running and a huge success.
It was great. Right. Like I said, don't pinch me. Do not pinch me. I'm enjoying this.
Will not do. Plus, I don't want to be slapped, so we'll leave it at that. No pinching on this show. With that being said, though, when is the next event coming up? I'm sure you guys are starting to schedule a few more events already.
We are. Our very next one will actually be at the TAPS home office in Warwick, Rhode Island, and that will be December 10th and 11th.
Very cool.
Yeah, that's going to be fun. There won't be an investigation attached to that one, but the classes are both days, so it's either the 10th or the 11th. And then I don't have the specific dates on some of these, but I do know we'll be at the Preston Castle in California in February, and in March we will be in Kansas City, Missouri. So we're really starting to book out and have some great locations that we don't have confirmed yet, but very exciting.
Yeah, that's awesome. I'm so glad for you guys. And of course, if people want to find out, they can go to the website. Or if any teams out there who are listening or anyone who's listening is interested in bringing in the TAPS Academy, they can do that as well, correct?
Absolutely. So just let us know. We've got locations coming in all the time, emails popping up. Well, can you come here? Can you go? Hey, if there's a place for us to stand and speak, then we'll do it. So
I love it. It's all about learning from the best, and that's what TAPS Academy brings. So that's great. So congratulations, Chris. I'm so happy for you guys.
Thanks. Thanks so much.
Yeah, and don't forget, if you're joining us here tonight on TAPS Family Radio, you can join us in our chat room at our website, tapsfamilyradio.net, tapsfamilyradio.net, and we are in the chat room. You can come on in, and it's a great place for you to be if you want to ask any questions of our TAPS Family team coming up in a little bit, or our main guest later this evening, who, by the way, is going to be David Roundtree. Let me just say, if you are a fan of EVPs, and for me, I am. That has always been my thing, the audio side of things. And I, you know, I'm sure it has a lot to do with the fact that I work in radio, so I'm around audio and all the gizmos and gadgets and stuff like that. So I've always enjoyed doing the EVP side of things, the paranormal. I'm so excited to talk to David Roundtree, who, if you want to talk about a guy who has the credentials to really work as an EVP specialist, this guy's got it.
I'm excited. I've been looking forward to this one for quite some time. I'm like you. I love EVP, but this guy's views and the things he's doing, pretty amazing stuff.
Absolutely. So we'll be talking to David Roundtree coming up a little bit later this hour as we get closer towards the second hour of our show. So with that being said, let's get on over to the little segment we like to do where we take a look at some news headlines from around the world, either the interesting, the strange, the funny, the weird, the offbeat. We take them all and we share a couple headlines right now during our show. I always like to go ladies first, Chris. If you'd like to go first, May, if you'd like for me to go first, I'm going to leave it up to you.
Well, you know, I'll go first. Tim, you've always heard you can't take it with you, right?
I have heard that, yes.
You should probably try, or at least take a little bit of funds or some money, a credit card, something, especially if you're going to be buried in a Spanish cemetery in a city called, Zaragoza City, because what they're doing is evicting people. For not pay, they do not sell grave sites, they lease them. I don't know, I guess in case you decide to come back, I don't know. But they lease them for 5 years up to 49 years, and they've had people not renewing their leases, if you can imagine, and they're evicting them. They've moved 420 crypts and moved them to just like a common burial ground. So you know, it's bad enough we've got to keep up with our bills while we're alive. It's apparently not over when we die.
Yeah, that I was just going to say, I thought those worries were supposed to leave us when we go to the next place, but it doesn't sound like it. I suppose you got to leave it up to the family. It must be the family's not paying the bills, I'm assuming.
Well, it said a lot of the families had themselves passed on, but they're looking at 7,000 burial sites that they may have to relocate that have not renewed their leases for 15 years or more. So
it's exactly reasons like this why I have told my wife, bury me in the backyard. There's just no need to worry about this. We have 14 acres. It's going to be me and Smokey the Bear hanging out. I mean, we've got plenty of room. I told her, just throw me out in the back 40 somewhere and let's call it good and save a little bit of money.
You know, there truly is no place like home. So maybe there's something to that.
That's right, exactly. Here is a story that I'm going to share at the expense of maybe getting our producer Cormac a little bit worried. Which, by the way, we welcome back Cormac as well, because we had producer Tom filling in last week too, and so it's good to have the whole family back here. But Tom and Larry were fantastic. I loved working with those guys, but it's great to have Cormac back as well behind the scenes and pushing the big shiny red buttons. But here's the deal: there's some mysterious radiation being detected across Europe.
Oh.
Yeah, the hunt is on for the source of a low-level radiation detected in the atmosphere across Europe over the past several days. Nuclear officials have found this and are looking. Trace amounts of iodine-131, which is a type of radiation created during the operation of a nuclear reactor or in the detonation of a nuclear weapon, were detected, by the Czech Republic State Office for Nuclear Safety starting 2 weeks ago. After the group reported its findings to the International Atomic Energy Agency, the agency released a statement. Now, the IAEA said that the current levels of iodine-131 are not high enough to warrant a public health risk, but they still don't know where it's coming from, and they will not say where it has been detected, where exactly it's been detected outside of the Czech Republic yet. But it's out there, it's floating, and they don't know where this stuff is coming from.
Oh, that's frightening. And, you know, if they're admitting that much, you know there's probably a whole lot that they're not fessing up to. It's pretty scary.
Yeah, I'm guessing, I'm going to guess someone, I mean, I'm just theorizing here, but to me it sounds like someone probably detonated a bomb, a test run, and some of it's leaking out is what I'm thinking.
Not good. You know, the things that we have out there that are supposedly for our defense and all that, I understand the necessity of needing them, but boy, look what happens.
Right, exactly.
Kind of scary.
What else we got?
Well, I thought this was interesting. It's not necessarily this week's news, but it reminded me of, I can't think of the movie. Anyway, it was a great movie. You'll have to see it sometime. There was a mysterious cipher code cracked, and I've always thought those were really amazing because they're so secretive. You have to know what they are. National Treasure, that's the movie I'm thinking of.
A very good movie, yeah.
Yeah, well, this one, and I'm going to mess up this one, too. I've got to stop getting stories with foreign languages in them. This one is the Copiale cipher, I guess. It's a 105-page book that was written in 1866, which producer Cormac did the math. It's 145 years ago. And they've been trying to crack the cipher in this book for, well, probably since then, really. They thought it was in German at one point, and then they decided that that was wrong. So they finally decoded the first 16 pages of it, and it turns out that it's a set of rules and initiation rites for some secret society.
Really?
Pretty cool, huh?
That's very cool. Yeah, that's stuff of Hollywood right there.
Yeah, real-life Hollywood.
Yeah, accepting new members? Are they starting a new group?
I don't know. I want to find out what the rules are. I bet we qualify. I mean, who wouldn't want us?
Yes,
right?
Exactly right.
Maybe I could take some of their secret rules and put them into the TAPS family member program and, you know.
I like it. And we'll become secret society.
That's right. Shh.
Yeah. Here's a very cool story to end things on tonight. I had read this actually a couple days ago. Jacob Anthony Sadin won't have any trouble remembering precisely when he was born. A U.S. hospital says Jacob entered the world at 11:11 a.m. on Friday, which was 11/11/11. And to make the Veterans Day birth, because that was Veterans Day in the U.S., remember?
Right.
And to make the Veterans Day birth even more remarkable, the boy's mother is an Air Force veteran and his father is serving in the Air Force currently. So how cool is that?
You just gave me chills. That is a cool story. And you have to wonder, there's so much mystery around the 11/11 enigma. And to have his birthday be 11/11/11 at 11/11, that's amazing.
Yeah, and all on Veterans Day to two vets. I mean, that's fantastic.
That is.
Very, very cool story. And that does remind me, too, even though it's a bit past, it's Tuesday, and last Friday was Veterans Day, to all of our veterans listening in the States and in Canada, because it's also Remembrance Day in Canada as well. We want to wish all the veterans of those countries a happy belated Veterans Day, Remembrance Day, and thank you for your service, for sure.
Absolutely.
Yeah. And with that being said, we are going to take a break. It's time to check in with some of our ads, play a little bit of tunage for you. And then when we come back, we are going to be highlighting one of our TAPS family teams for you this evening. This is TAPS Family Radio on Jackalope Radio.
Starting out as a paranormal investigator can be very overwhelming. Where to start, who to talk to, how to handle yourself in the field. Until now. Learn from the best. Learn from the official training program of the Atlantic Paranormal Society and the TAPS family by attending the TAPS Academy. The TAPS Academy is a comprehensive one-day informational lecture and investigation training course, all based on a scientific approach to the paranormal. You'll cover paranormal theory, research methods, technology in the paranormal research, and much more. To find out when and where the next TAPS Academy will be, or to bring the TAPS Academy to your hometown, simply log on to www.tapsacademy.com or phone 401-400-1266. That's 401-400-1266. You have to learn from the best to be the best. And now you can.
with TAPS Academy.
Hidden in the shadows of Dublin, the small and unassuming area known as Carlow, Ireland, holds a haunted history that you may not know about. The town dates back to before Ireland's written history. But now, its haunted history has been written and recorded by authors Cormac Strain and Danny Carthy. Haunted Carlow takes you on an eerie and fascinating journey through pubs, cafes, private homes, and schools. Go to hauntedcarlow.com or amazon.com to get your copy today and see a side of Carlow, Ireland you never knew existed.
If you are in need of a professional, experienced, and confidential paranormal investigation at a home or commercial location, the International Paranormal Reporting Group is ready to talk with you. For more information about us and other services we offer, or to interact with team members and people just like you, visit us online at IPRGC.com. That's IPRGC.com. The International Paranormal Reporting Group is a proud TAPS family member.
You're listening to TAPS Family Radio, the coolest place on the web.
And welcome back to TAPS Family Radio on this Tuesday evening. Tim Ellis, Chris Perkins with you. And thank you for being with us here tonight on TFR. Of course, our home for TFR is Jackalope Radio. Thank you for tuning in. And once again, don't forget you can join us in our chat room at tapsfamilyradio.net. Click on the main page, and then right there you'll see chat. Click on that and come on in and well, chat with us. That's what it's all about. Also, don't forget, if you've got the iPhone, you can download our free iPhone app for TFR. You can listen to TAPS Family Radio anytime, anywhere on your phone. So check that out as well. And it is free. And, well, we all love free. And right now, it is time to highlight one of the many wonderful teams that make up the TAPS family. And tonight, Chris, who do we speak with and where do they hail from?
Well, Tim, one of the things that I really love about TAPS Academy is now I get to actually meet the teams in the family. You know, we talk on the phone, we email, but this is putting me face-to-face with them, and I love it. Mm-hmm. We are highlighting tonight the Virginia Paranormal Society, who we worked with this past weekend, but more specifically, it's the Southern Branch, which is led by Mike St. Clair. So we have Mike with us tonight. Mike, can you hear us?
I can hear you great. Can you hear me?
We can hear you just fine, and welcome aboard tonight. Appreciate you making the time for us. I know, have you recovered yet?
I believe I'm about 95% right now, so I think I'm good to go. But it did take a couple days.
Oh, I'm telling you, I think I slept from 5 o'clock yesterday afternoon to about 5 o'clock this morning. I'm good now.
I was really dragging.
Well, you know, all the hard work paid off. I know that you helped in the evening, or I guess you could call that evening. It ended at 5 o'clock in the morning, but you helped doing the tours and all of that. So we'll get into that in just a few minutes. You also presented a little bit. So I'd like to talk about that, but let's talk about Virginia Paranormal Society a bit first. Now, you are the lead of the Southern Branch, correct?
Correct.
Okay, and then are there just two branches now?
There is us, of course. We have Paranormal SWAT, which I'm not sure exactly where that is, but it's in Virginia, I believe. And then we have Northern Virginia, and Chris Losher. I actually joined VPS this year. I had my own team, Viper Paranormal. I started that in 2008,
right,
and started working a bit with Nick Farah. There's your shout out, Nick. You told me to give you one. But I'd been working with Nick for a while, and he decided he wanted to have me aboard the team as a lead investigator, and, you know, kind of started that, and that's how it happened. And I've been with VPS since, and we all work together great, and it's so much fun. I love working with these guys.
Well, I tell you what, Nick is a good guy. You kind of get that feel for him anyway, just working with him to the limited capacity I had before. But being able to meet him, truly, he's very, very nice and has put together a great team. So it's no surprise that he recognized quality and wanted to bring it on board when he saw you and brought you in. So, and, you know, getting just to hang around you guys, I really was impressed with everybody. It's nice when a team comes together that well. So when Virginia has a case that's maybe between the two of you, do the two teams work together, or is it just lucky that you guys all work together that well?
It really depends where it's at. Sometimes we do work together. I haven't had a lot of chances to work with the other VPS teams because most of the investigations have been close to Roanoke, where I live. But I believe next weekend we've got one in West Virginia, and I believe some of the other guys are going to be coming in with that. So we had one instance, we were doing some VPS training, and I got to get together with SWAT and the Northern Virginia team and the I guess it's Southwest Virginia. I think that's where I'm from. I've only lived here 32 years, I don't know. But we all got to work together then, and that was the first time. And, you know, it was amazing how much knowledge and talent is on this team. It's just phenomenal. I mean, these guys really know what they're doing. It's, you know, it's great to be a part of that.
Well, I know you guys seem to cover that state very well, and you know, we've had great things come back from the clients about how well the state is covered or how their cases are handled and things like that. So now, you mentioned your investigation coming up in West Virginia next weekend, but you did not mention why you might not be able to go.
Well, got this little thing called a baby on the way, and she's due December the 13th, but the docs seem to think she's going to be coming a little sooner than that, so it could really happen at any moment, and there's just no way I'm going to chance being 3 hours away from home.
Aww.
And missed it, this one. So Nick's going to be coming in on this one, and he's going to be jumping in on it, and we've got some of our other guys from here that's going to be helping out with it. So, I mean, I'm 100% confident the case is going to go great, and it's going to be covered really well.
Oh, I'm sure it will. And I know they're all more than happy to jump in and help out, knowing you've got a great reason there. Congratulations
exactly.
Ahead of time.
Thank you.
Congratulations, Mike.
This is actually the first case that I've missed. So it's kind of weird not being there, but I know they're going to do great. So I'm confident. So
that's awesome. Awesome. Do you have a name picked out for her yet?
Zoe Irene Jade.
Well, you know, if you just wanted to add another middle name in there, I think Kristen has a nice ring. I'm just saying, you know, or Tim would be a good thing to throw in there too.
For a girl, I don't know. I don't know.
He could start something.
I think
we'll go with
Kristen. He could start something, but I think Kristen fits better.
Well, so Mike, when you were with us this weekend, you took part of our presentation, and I could tell that you have slightly an interest in the technical end and in the evidence review part of it. That's what you did for us. Mike presented evidence review, and you can tell when somebody has a passion about those sorts of things. And so tell me a little bit about, now I got to watch some of it. I'll be honest with you, we were so busy I didn't get to watch all of it. But tell me a little bit about how your team handles evidence review. I know, you know, we leave these investigations and sometimes it's hard to turn around right away and get to things. Do you guys have a time limit, or how do you handle that? How does it go after you leave the investigation?
Well, I like to have everything finished. Usually our investigations are on Friday or Saturday night. I prefer Friday nights because it's better for me. But sometimes, you know, we have to do them on Saturday nights. But I like to have them finished by the next weekend. I like to have all the evidence reviewed. Depending upon the severity of the case, you know, I mean, if it's something serious going on, you know, and there's children involved, or, you know, the client's frightened, we don't stand for that. People shouldn't be afraid to live in their own house. So we try to jump on it a little quicker. We get through it as fast as we can, and usually we don't get the chance to get together a lot and review all together. So generally, we sit back and kind of review things on our own time. Whenever we have, you know, a little bit of free time, we'll jump in on it, you know, try to get it knocked out. And after we're finished, you know, we'll contact each other and share what we have. And usually when we share what we have, that's where we start debunking everything, unfortunately. But, you know, a good debunk is just as good as a good piece of evidence. That's what I always say. So.
Oh, I believe so, too. In fact, yeah. I said it at the lecture this weekend, you know, that it was almost just as satisfying to be able to debunk something. And the look on their faces was like, what? But it really is.
Yeah, it is.
Because sometimes, you know, you can bring a lot of peace of mind that way, too. So.
Yeah.
So now, how, when you spend 6-8 hours in somebody's home, I know usually team members will bring their own recorders, voice recorders, and things like that. Does everybody just take their own stuff to review, or how does that work with your team?
Usually that's what we do. Whatever we record, you know, we take it and listen to it ourselves or view it ourselves. And unless, you know, we have a particular investigator with, you know, 4 or 5 voice recorders running it. Well, actually, not quite that many. But, you know, if one of us has a couple voice recorders running, you know, and somebody was not able to attend the investigation, you know, we'll pass the voice off to them and let them, you know, review some of it so that one person isn't stuck with everything. When I started my Team Viper, but before I got up with VPS, I found that I was reviewing everything. It was really difficult to do, especially when you had a lot of stuff to do. So we like to split the stuff up as much as we can. And for the most part, we usually, whatever we shoot, whatever, you know, we record, we review it ourselves. But sometimes, you know, sometimes we're unable to do it that way, and we just pass it off to another team member because we don't want to spend too much time on it. You know, we like to get back on it, you know, when everything's still fresh in our minds, you know, the investigation, what went on, what things happened, you know.
Well, we were getting a little bit broken up again, but I think we got all of that. How about your DVR? That's one thing, you know, everybody's so happy about hooking up 32 cameras or however many you have, and then that one poor soul has to take that DVR home and watch the whole thing. So how do you handle that? You guys have a couple, I know you said when people can get together or not always, you know, you can't always get everybody together, but who takes the DVR home? Is that following you?
Well, no, it doesn't. It's great. Jason Lundy, he's responsible for all of that. So thank you, Jason Lundy. He is he's the founder of Roanoke's Investigation of Paranormal. I know it's really confusing. We joined forces with him back in 2010. He started the year after I did. And, you know, we had the same techniques, the you know, the same protocol and the same morals. So we decided, you know, we were going to join forces together. But for the Viper and Roanoke's Investigation of the Paranormal team, he's the one that had the DVR. So usually we take that on the VPS cases as well. But we like to try a technique. Now, this doesn't always work, but sometimes it does. It really depends on, you know, where the cameras are placed. A lot of times, you know, the DVR is nothing more than to see where our investigators are at, because, you know, there's not always claims of, you know, apparitions and objects moving and things like that you can catch on video. So a lot of times it's pretty much just to see where we are. Now, I think you guys covered that at the Taps Academy as well.
Right.
But we like to have 2 to 3 investigators sitting at the base station, actually reviewing this live. We bring the biggest monitor we can, and you know, a couple of those cameras we can actually review live. So it's instead of having to go home and review every single second of that. And you know, if you're running 4 cameras for 8 hours, that's 32 hours. That's a day and a half. That's a lot of stuff to review. It's almost impossible to do all of that. So we do some live review. You know, of course, any time someone steps away from the DVR, you know, we mark that time down, because you know, you can't afford to miss anything. So the more of that we can review live during the investigation, the better. So, you know, maybe instead of having 4 cameras to have to review, you know, we only have 2 cameras to have to review, and you know, any time we took breaks in between that. So that helps a lot with the review, especially when you're running a lot of equipment. I tell people, you know, it's best as much equipment as you can, but don't run if you don't plan on reviewing it.
Oh, right. And you know, like you were saying, I wonder about those people with 32 cameras or even 16. You know, that's a lot of reviewing. Tim, now I've never asked you that. How does your team really handle your DVR review and all of that?
Actually, you know, it's really interesting to hear Mike talking about it, and I love it when we can tap in with other teams like this and kind of hear how they do things. And it's like identical. I mean, it's almost like I was sitting there with Mike and understanding exactly what he was saying, or I've been on an investigation with him, because our team does it the exact same way. We always try to keep at least 2 set of eyes on the DVR screen, because as Mike said, if you can, you know, watch it while you're in the field, that's going to save a lot of post time. And then, as Mike said, if we step away, we write down, we keep a log sheet right by it, and we write it down the time we step. Or if we saw something, you know, maybe something caught our eye, we also jot down so that the person who does go back in post review will look at the log and say, all right, something was spotted at this time on camera 3. He can go back and check it out that way. And also along those lines, I do the same thing with EVP. We bring a couple laptops along, set up a couple set of headphones, and then as people come back from doing EVP work, we drop it right into the computer, and it can actually start listening then as well, because the hope is if you hear something, you can say, all right, guys, we picked up something, you know, at this place. Let's go back there and try to do some more EVP work. So we also try to eliminate some of the audio as well while we're actually in the field.
Wow. You know, I never thought about doing that with the audio. We do the same with the video, but I've never thought about the audio. That's a good idea.
Yeah, and it also helps, with boredom, because as you guys know, there's a lot of downtime in investigating, so this allows people who are back at, you know, headquarters to actually do stuff and keep them busy while the other teams might be out in the field doing EVP work and whatever.
Well, and the immediacy of that, if you got an EVP, you can turn around and do a little bit more with that.
Exactly.
That's great. Awesome. Yeah. Well, Mike, let's turn around and talk a little bit about that amazing place, that St. Albans. That
wow.
I didn't expect that. I really, truly did not expect that building to be like it was. You've been there before, right?
I've been there a couple times. When they had the haunted house to raise money for the building itself, the first night we went, we were setting up for Virginia Paratronics, and we also set up to talk to people as they were leaving. So we went out to represent VPS. You know, when people go through a haunted house, it's Halloween. Everybody's into the paranormal, and they want to talk about it. So we sat out there, and, you know, we talked to people as they left. You know, they were really happy about that. But we were fortunate enough to get a nice little four-hour investigation with a couple other teams. And it was the first time I'd been there. I saw photographs of the place, you know, and I was like, well, this looks like just a big oversized house. And then I got there, and I was like, wow, it's I couldn't believe how big it was. I mean, you could really get lost in that place.
Well, even just trying to look around the other night to lead people around, we got lost.
Yeah, it's easy.
And, well, Chris had been there before, and, you know, we were looking for there was a new section, Tim. This is incredible. You've got to look at this place. There was a new section that they actually had never found. They didn't know it was there, and I guess they found it from the outside first. And were able to see inside, and then later on found it behind a sheet of plywood or something. It's kind of, you know, in dilapidated condition, but so they found this extra area in October. And so we were some of the first people to go down into this other area. Now, a little bit about the history so that you can understand how interesting that is. It was at one point, okay, it was two things, Mike, correct? It was at one point a boys' home, am I right?
That's correct.
And it was also a sanatorium.
Yes.
Ooh. And so the new part that they opened up was in the closed female section, and it was just it was so sad. You go down there, and I didn't even think about this until Chris pointed it out to me. There were no handles on the backs of the doors.
No, there were not.
So once they put them in there, of course, they shut the door, and they were locked in. It was just an amazing place. It was a maze, a labyrinth. I mean, it was just incredible. There's even a bowling alley in there, a two-lane bowling alley inside the building. I'm sorry?
Is it, but not workable now, is it?
Oh, no. The whole building is just not usable. It's, you know, kind of torn up inside. And I understand that they're looking to restore a lot of it. But right now, it's just, in fact, there were areas of it that weren't able to go into because it was just not safe for our guests to go in.
Right. Yeah, it was really, really bad shape in some areas. May I interject here? I have a couple of things I'd like to say.
I'm sorry?
May I interject?
Absolutely.
You were talking about the bowling alley. It's not working. There's no bowling pins there. There were no bowling balls there. But one of the guys on our team, before we went down for the haunted house, he said, "Hey, Mike, I got an idea." He said, "I'm going to stop by the Goodwill here and pick up a bowling ball." And I was like, "Yeah, get a bowling ball. Yeah, get it." So he gets this thing, and we take it out there, and the whole team went down, and we took a black Sharpie and signed it, and put our team names and our individual names, and kind of left it down there as a gift to who or whatever was there that may have enjoyed that bowling alley when they were here, and the bowling alley was still functional. So we left a little gift for I hate using the word spirits, but we left a little gift for them so they could have a little fun while we're not there. And, you know, a lot of people have been using it as a trigger object, you know, trying to get it to roll. And from my understanding, an investigator did actually witness the ball move last weekend on the investigation.
Oh, wow. I hadn't heard that yet. I'm still kind of waiting to hear all the claims coming in. I do know that they were getting some EMF spikes down there. So, So I haven't heard, you know, all of the stories yet. Is that maybe what you were referring to? But I saw that. And then speaking of trigger objects, there were some in Jacob's room.
Yes.
And now I never was able to corner anybody to tell me the story of Jacob's room. Do you happen to know it?
Not really.
I know everybody just called it Jacob's room.
What I was told was it was there's a little boy spirit there named Jacob. I don't recall how old he is, but some of the other teams that have investigated there claim that they believe that it's not a little boy at all. It's something maybe a little more negative than that. They're posing as a little boy.
Oh, I see.
That's about all I know about it. I've been in that room a few times. Haven't really had any experiences in there. We heard some footsteps walking outside the door at one time. You know, that could have easily been someone on another floor, because we had several teams loose in there when we were investigating. So.
Well, I know that Chris and I were walking around, and what we would do, the Virginia Paranormal people were just awesome. They broke our guests up into teams and took them around the sanatorium. And so what Chris and I were able to do was then go float around and visit each one of those teams and just see how they were doing and what they had picked up. And while we were on the way from one team to another, I think it was right above that closed women's quarters, so I think it was the open area. There was a chair that was kind of off of the flooring and onto some concrete. The front legs were sticking on some concrete. And as we walked by the door, we heard that chair scoot over. It probably scooted over a good couple of inches because we heard it drag across the concrete.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, we were the only people there. And, of course, so right away we marked the place, you know, where their legs were on the concrete. And, you know, having not been there before, I didn't know this at the time, but that's a common report back there. So pretty interesting. If anybody gets a chance to go, you know, from what I understand, they're planning to maybe have some more events there in the future.
Mm-hmm.
If they do have these, it is definitely worth the time and trouble to go. It not only has a history and a history worth sharing and telling, it's just an incredible place. When you walk around and soak in all of the things that probably happened there. Both when it was a sanatorium and then also when it was a boys' home, you know, it's just got an amazing history. Even the architecture inside, some of the archways and things like that. I think there's something there for everybody. But
that was actually going to be my question: is it open? You know, is it open for groups to go in and rent the night out kind of thing? And it sounds like you're saying they might be, or you're not sure.
Well, I know there's a group that works with them on a regular basis, and I don't know if they're planning any in the future. I know that they said we were more than welcome to come back, so that may be something that we look into. But in talking with the people there that evening, I know that they do plan to do a little bit of restorative work and make it a little safer. Not that we put anybody in danger, but there are some leaks and things like that that they would like to take care of. So as they do that, I'm pretty sure preparing to be able to let people in on a more regular basis.
Right.
But they should bring a guide. I'm not telling you, we got so lost at one point that we finally just went outside and walked around to the front of the building because we could not find, we were trying to find the caged area, and I know that sounds terrible, but there's a kind of a patio upstairs that's caged in so that the patients could go outside and get their sun and their fresh air, but still be safe and contained. And we were trying to find it and just gave up and went out the front door and walked around to the back.
When all else fails, find the exit.
That's right.
It's hard to find things in that place. It really is. It's so big. If we've got a second, I'd like to talk about something. You had said something about the new place they opened up, the women's seclusion area.
Sure.
The first night I was there helping out with the haunted house and whatnot, we did that investigation with, it was 3:33 a.m. Paranormal and Appalachian Paranormal. And those are the guys that were on the, it's, what's the show that, Ghost Adventures,
one where they competed, Paranormal Challenge.
Paranormal Challenge, that's yeah. Right. And they were on Paranormal Challenge. Well, so I was walking around with 3:33 and we get to this one area and there's, you know, they had the haunted house set up. So there's, you know, tarps and plastic everywhere. So we lifted up this little piece and walked around and, we saw this stairwell and, you know, she's like, you know, I don't recall ever seeing this. What is this? And sure enough, it brought us right down into that women's seclusion area. Now, when I'm on an investigation, I keep it 100% scientific or as scientific as I can be. I try not to go off of feelings too much, but, you know, sometimes they're hard to avoid. Well, we get down in there and within a couple minutes, I start getting a pain in my chest. Like a pressure, like maybe something was trying to squeeze me. I mean, I didn't feel any hands or anything. You know, I just felt this pressure. And of course, you know, there are some hazards there. They have had some asbestos, and I'm sure there's mold and things like that because it is an old building and water does get in there. But, you know, at first I thought, you know, I could be having a reaction to something. You know, we may better move along, you know. And the other investigator wasn't having any problems. So, you know, we decided to move on. And, you know, 5-10 minutes passed, you know, that pressure started getting more intense, to the point where, you know, I was getting a little uncomfortable. I'd never had anything like this happen during a paranormal investigation before. And a couple minutes after that, not only was my chest hurting, but I felt the pressure up at my collarbone and kind of around my neck a little bit. And it got more intense and more intense and more intense. And there's this room that has a big bathtub in it. I'm guessing that's where the patients bathe or whatever. So I took my flashlight and I peeped into the room a little bit. It's a really small room, and then the bathtub takes up just about half of the room. So there's not much room for anything in there. And I peeped around a little bit, and I took one step into that room, and when I did, it's like everything I had was gone. My knees got weak, my legs went to jelly. You know, I staggered a bit because I couldn't hold myself up, and this went on for about 45 minutes. About 30 minutes after we exited the seclusion area, I still had this pressure in my chest, and it was one of the strangest things I've ever experienced. Tried to go back to try to maybe disprove it, to see if maybe it was something I was having a reaction to. And I've been down there 4 times since, nothing even comparing to what had happened to me down there. So I had an amazing experience down there that I'll never forget as long as I live.
Oh, so, wow.
There's a cool little story from the seclusion area.
I'm kind of glad I didn't hear that until now.
Oh, one other thing. I'm sorry I'm taking up all the time. I'll try to make this quick. Mountain Ridge Paranormal Society, those are the ones that do the tours and everything there. So the weekend after this happened, I was talking to one of the guys. He's like, yeah, we had this guy come in. He was a big skeptic, you know, and we took him down to the seclusion area, and he stood there for a minute, you know, and he started getting this, you know, horrible pressure in his chest, and it just kept on and kept on and kept on. And the whole time I'm thinking, oh, my God, that's the same thing that happened to me. So, you know, someone else validated that, you know, having no idea my experience and not knowing what happened to me, experienced the exact same thing. So, you know, that's kind of validation for, you know, possible activity down there. So
it is. Wow. Just an amazing place. And I, yeah. I encourage anybody, because, you know, now that you've said that, anybody to go try it out. But truly, I mean, so many people left having had experiences, not quite like yours, but having had experiences the other night that, gosh, I really can't say enough about it. Just a truly, truly special place. If they want to look for it online, I have found that if you put St. Albans, Albans, and then Radford, Radford, that's going to take you to the correct place.
Now, there are 2 St. Albans in Radford.
Oh, maybe it won't take you to the correct place.
We got lost going out there the first night. We drove around for about 2 hours trying to find this place. At the New River Valley Hospital, I believe that's what it's called, there's a St. Albans there as well, and it's still called St. Albans. So there are actually 2 of those. So just make sure you have the right one. It's on University something Drive.
Well, and this is the historic one. Current St. Albans, there was actually I believe she was a phlebotomist from the current St. Albans. So I think if they put historic St. Albans, they might get to the right place. Definitely if they put the word paranormal with it, they're going to get it. So.
Oh, definitely.
Well, Mike, hey, thank you so much for jumping in here tonight. It was nice to be able to share your stories about that great place, and for you to be able to share some of the insight about your team with us tonight. I so appreciate you coming in, and you represented Virginia Paranormal very well. I'll tell Nick you did well.
Thank you very much, and thanks for having me. I really enjoyed it. I always enjoy running my mouth about paranormal. So.
Oh, well, anytime. You're welcome back anytime. You take care.
All right, you do the same. Talk to you guys later.
All right, thanks, Mike.
All right, no problem. Bye-bye.
All right, there we go. Mike St. Clair from the Virginia Paranormal Society, but the Southern chapter of that great group from the one of the men. The great Taps family teams out there kicking butt and taking names. And you guys have got me all intrigued now about this place. I got to check it out.
You need to go. I can't say enough about it. Just incredible place.
Very cool. Well, here's the deal. We are going to take a break. When we come back, we're going to be bringing to you a specialist in the field of EVPs. And we all love those. His name is David Roundtree. He's up next here on Taps Family Radio, live from Jackalope Radio.
You're listening to Taps Family Radio. We'll be tired of wondering where to get the best ghost hunting gear at the best price? Wondering if you're being ripped off or if the product is high quality and can last the rugged life of a ghost hunter? Your fear and search is over. Creepy Hollow Gear is the home of ghost hunting gear made by ghost hunters for ghost hunters. Founded by Paul Bradford of Sci-Fi Channel's Ghost Hunters International, Paul wanted to create a place where all the equipment was proven and tested in the field. Some even built by Paul and his team, making Creepy Hollow Gear the only place you can get some of this equipment. Check them out for yourself at www.creepyhollowgear.com, where you'll find a place that is set up for teams and enthusiasts who aren't inclined to build their own equipment or kit. A site that has the top gear at prices a team on a budget can afford. A place where people can try new equipment and technology. That's www.creepyhollowgear.com. Ghost hunting gear made by ghost hunters for ghost hunters.
The Taps family is truly international. If you live in the peninsula of Fife on the eastern border of Scotland and feel you may have a haunting, there's help. Scottish Paranormal, a proud Taps family member, is a scientific-based paranormal research team that is dedicated to the study of the unknown, helping individuals, families, and business owners over the past 6 years. Scottish Paranormal is ready to help you. Their work is confidential and no charge for service will ever be asked of their clients. If you feel you need the help of Scottish Paranormal, then go to their website at www.scottish-paranormal.com. co.uk.
You're listening to Taps Family Radio.
And welcome back to Taps Family Radio on this Tuesday evening. TFR live on Jackalope Radio. Thank you for being out there and tuning in and hanging out because, as we always say, without you, we can't do what we do. So thank you for tuning in and being a part of it. And hopefully you'll also spread the word about the show and also let people know that you can download our shows anytime at our website, by the way, which is tapsfamilyradio.net. You can download and check out any of our shows from doesn't matter how far back since our beginning. Are there on the website. You can check them out there. Don't forget about our free iPhone app, which you can download free from the website as well. And that way you can take your phone with you and take TFR along with you and listen to our shows anytime. Well, if you are like myself and Chris, and the one thing that you love about getting out there in the field and investigating is the EVPs, electronic voice phenomena. Do we have a gentleman that you are going to love to hear from tonight? It is his specialty. This is a guy who truly can wear the badge and say EVP specialist because of his background, and he'll be telling us all about it right now. He is the author of the book, Paranormal Technology, Understanding the Science of Ghost Hunting. Please welcome to TFR tonight, David Roundtree. David, good evening, and thanks for being with us.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Oh, so excited. I know you and I and Chris were talking a little bit off the air here and both just kind of saying how, you know, all three of us really love the whole idea of EVPs. It's very exciting. It's there's something very, even though you can sit there and listen for hours of you asking a question and getting nothing, there's still that anticipation of waiting to hear that voice.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And what's even better is when you're not asking questions and you're letting your gear run for hours and hours and hours. And
yes.
You think that you didn't get anything, that it was a dull and boring night. And then you get home and you start going through your evidence and you find, like, you know, there's this entire, like, conversation going on or something. And that's like, holy mackerel. So,
yeah.
You know, and I've been pleasantly surprised with that many times. We do our EVP work a little differently than most groups because, you know, everybody does the as seen on TV version where they go around and they ask questions. Some people even, you know, like try to just stimulate these things into being angry and that sort of stuff, provoking it. Everything. We go in and we wire a place for sound and then we leave. We sit outside for a while and we talk and then we will come back in routinely every hour or so to check on equipment, change batteries and stuff. Do like a 15-minute walkthrough and then leave again because the instrumentation that we're using actually can record us moving into the environment. So we like to have our interaction on record, but we also like to have no human interaction on record where we're just gathering the data. So it's a little bit different idea behind it, but it tends to be really good when you get an EVP because there's virtually no contamination.
Yeah, exactly. I couldn't agree more. We kind of do both, actually. We do a combination of both. We set our recorders in the field and let them do their thing as well, and we let those just run all night. And each team is also armed with their own recorder so that when they do go, they have that with them as well.
Yep, absolutely.
So let's go right back to the very beginning, man. When did this all start for you? When did you know the paranormal was something that intrigued you and you had to learn more?
I guess I was about 8 years old, maybe.
Pretty young.
Yeah, I was pretty young. When I was really young, I'd had some personal experience with a death in the family, my grandfather and stuff. And so I had had some experiences, personal experiences that were hard for me to explain, but really, it really started for me, like I say, when I was 8 years old. My family had moved to Florida from Virginia. My next-door neighbor was a retired professor. He was a engineering professor, but he was also a pattern maker in his retirement. He would make patterns for, you know, foundries and things like that to pour fittings and that sort of stuff. And he taught me all kinds of kid stuff like, you know, trigonometry and things like that. But anyway, he had this library. And in this library were like several hundred books on the paranormal and classic books on the paranormal, books that were written by, you know, Charles Fort. I mean, I think one of the first books I read of his was Book of the Damned. But he had books from, you know, Frank Edwards. He had all of these classic authors from like the 40s, 50s, and 60s, all the old UFO authors. And I read every book he had. I mean, I learned about raining frogs and, you know, everything you can imagine. And then when I finished with what he had, I went to the public library. And then I read every book that the public library had on the paranormal, which back in those days was probably about 40 books, maybe. And I read all of those. When I was 17, the night, or 18, the night of my graduation, we all went to a haunted house. And that was like my first experience going to a haunted house. And we had some stuff happen that we couldn't explain. So right after that, I went into the Air Force, went to the service, ended up getting my college degree while I was in the service, got out. And when I got out, and in 1976, I decided I'm going to try to find out what's going on. And that's when the professional journey began. I hobbled together some equipment. I had a TAC 40A4010S reel-to-reel recorder, weighed about 45, 50 pounds. I had a Tektronix 545B oscilloscope that weighed about 70 pounds. I had a converted U.S. Army mine detector that we had turned into a passive receiver instead of a transponder so that we listen for EMF.
I love it.
Yeah, and it all kind of fit into a U-Haul trailer. And we could test maybe four parameters, you know, of the environment with all of that. And that's what we did. We went, and unfortunately, though, back then, you couldn't go to someone's house and look for ghosts because they would lock you up in the nut house. So you had to go to abandoned places or places there where there were no witnesses. To do these kind of things and to run experiments. And one of the first things we did was that we did a bell jar experiment where I had suspected for quite a while that EVP was not in any way, shape, or fashion related to audio at all. But I had to figure something out to disprove it. And one of the things that we tried was we took a bell jar. I had a friend that was in the chemistry department at the University of Florida, so we went in and we borrowed a bar one night at an evacuation pump, and we mounted a old Shure microphone, dynamic microphone, inside of a bell jar, and then evacuated all the air from it, and we set it up in an area which we had caught EVPs in prior. And sure enough, you know, sound will not travel in a vacuum. Mm-hmm. So since we had created a vacuum, we were pretty certain that we weren't going to record anything, but sure enough, we got an EVP.
Oh, wow.
So, and then we took everything apart and we pulled the microphone out of the bell jar and we discovered that it couldn't have been sound anyway because when we had vacated the chamber, we had severely damaged the diaphragm from the vacuum and separated it completely from the voice coil. So we caught it with just the voice coil. So that told me that, hey, you know what? It's electromagnetic field exciting the coil. But we didn't directly have proof that that's what it was. So you have to kind of fast forward to like 2001 when we finally had the technology
right
to definitively prove that EVP was being caused by EMF in the audio spectrum, specifically in the human voice spectrum. So once we did that, then we started looking and saying, hey, where's it coming from, you know? And we were running RF spectrum analyzers. We were monitoring local broadcasts, police broadcasts, commercial bands, trying to figure out if we were getting like demodulated audio from RF carrier waves or what was going on. And it turns out that it seemed like this stuff was sort of like just appearing. Well, I had to build a device, of course, to try to figure out where it was emerging from, because there's nothing off the shelf really available in your local Radio Shack to find emerging EMFs. So we built this thing that's kind of on the order of like an old radio direction finder type technology, where years ago during World War II, they would use like different receivers in triangulation, and they would be able to locate based on the signal strength where someone was transmitting from. Well, we sort of do the same thing with low frequencies with this device, where we set up four sensors in the perimeter around the room and point them inwards, and we have the back of it shielded by Mu metal so that we don't get any interference from the back side of it. And then we scan the room, and sure enough, we discover that EMF was literally emerging into the environment, like specific enough to say, well, it emerged a foot and a half off the floor, 3 feet from the wall. Wow. Next to the sofa there. I mean, we were able to triangulate it that close. And once we did that, then we threw everything we had at that area, that very localized area, and measured what was going on with the environment in that area, and we discovered some pretty incredible things.
That's pretty specific when you can get it down to, you know, that far off the ground and in this area. That's pretty groundbreaking.
That's
stuff.
Amazing.
Yeah.
Well, and the technology I'm using is actually analog and very outdated, because I already have a friend who is working on a totally digital version of this that will run off a laptop, where literally you can set wireless sensors or wired sensors in a room and literally display what the scanners are seeing, what those sensors are seeing on your laptop screen, and be able to physically see where different fields are. You can do temperature shifts. You can do, I think right now we have the capability of measuring four different parameters, and we're going to develop up to, probably we'll have about 12 parameters altogether when we're done. But, and I met this other guy who, this is kind of a little side trip, but I met another guy at the a ghost show that was recently in Austin, Texas. And he worked for Dell Computers, and he was telling me how he was developing a display cube, which, based on different layers of clear material, could be lit up with LEDs, and you could literally generate a holographic three-dimensional representation of whatever data you were collecting. So you could literally take a display like that and say, this is the room, and you could physically place these three-dimensional display things in that cube so that you could see exactly how the field was oriented, what the area of coverage and effect of it was. I mean, huge, huge stuff here. And I've lost, he was supposed to get back in touch with me, and I've never heard from him again. So if he's listening to my voice, email me. Because we want to get you together with the guy developing the sensor stuff so we can put a system together that will be awesome. But the idea is, though, is we're constantly data logging the environment. And by doing that, we have a stream of real-time data. We can correlate that data with personal experiences, with other data from cameras or from recorders, and say, hey, when this event happened, look at what happened here. And that's huge stuff. I mean, that's evidence that gets out of the realm of debunkability.
Yeah. And I got to tell you, having guests on like you, David, and a handful of other guests that we've had on through the years, it's so encouraging to me, because I got to believe that we are on the doorstep of being able to truly start to prove some things here in the field of the paranormal with folks like you out there. Who have the know-how to break it in, you know, with devices like this. So to me, it's very encouraging to know that folks like you are out there doing this kind of work.
Absolutely, and to be honest with you, for 35 years, I stayed unknown, just because I didn't want to come forward with anything until I had all my facts and figures and I knew what was going on to that degree, so that I could say, this is what it is, this is what's happening, this is what we've got going on, and be able to share how we got it with other people so they could replicate the work and say, hey, you're right, we're getting this too. And that's what the book has allowed me to do, is to come out in the open now, and I've got people all over the United States that are duplicating the work that we did. They're coming back and saying, hey, we're finding the same things. And it's a very exciting time, you're right, because I think it's a time when, you know, the field has been stagnant for so long, and we are seeing the same, literally the same protocols, the same tired old worn out things being done over and over again that we saw 10 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And there's literally nothing new being introduced other than gadgetry and things of that nature. We're really not discovering any more than we knew 10 years ago. So what's happened is that people are kind of like, you know, now what? So we're coming along at a time when people are hungry for something new.
Yeah.
And we're saying, hey, this is what we've got. This is what we've found. Let's all start looking for this, you know.
Exactly.
And maybe we can kick it up to the next level.
What I like is so many people out there, and we talk about this in TAPS Academy, so many people out there are calling themselves science-based. And they do that, I think, part of the time to kind of differentiate themselves from the more metaphysical-based groups.
Right, right.
Which, you know, they definitely have their own merit, and I definitely think there's a need to mix the two of them eventually. But without that science and without that methodology, we're really not going to make those advances. And so it is exciting to see people coming up with new things and new theories like you are and actually gaining something from that.
Absolutely. And the thing is one of the things, the goals of my book was, is I was so tired of seeing equipment misused, things being misnamed, effects being like totally explained incorrectly on TV that I thought, you know, the sad part about this is there's thousands of groups out there that are emulating the things that they see, and they're taking it out and they're just perpetuating the same things over again because there's nothing to give them any kind of protocol or base to go on except for what they see and what they read. So I'm going to give them something to read and hand them a nugget. And what I did was I took each piece of equipment that we use. I mean, from a camera all the way out to exotic stuff that most teams don't have and have never heard of and may never get their hands on. And I explain what it measures, you know, what the actual condition is it measures. Like I go into great detail about what light is, for example, and things of that nature. How to use the equipment. In other words, how to properly use it. I recommend the best kinds of equipment and the best places to buy them price-wise. And then I tell you how to take that, put it together with the other equipment I explain, and slowly build your case either for or against a paranormal event happening. So it's like a textbook almost, a handbook. It's like a field handbook. But I also include experiments that we've done. And I tell you exactly how we assemble the equipment. Most of the stuff is like from off-the-shelf purchases. Anyone can put it together. I tell you how we used it. I tell you what we found. And then I encourage people to do it themselves. You know, don't take our word for it. Do it yourself, you know. Don't accept what we give you at face value. Prove us wrong and tell us you prove us wrong if you do. You know, so we're not wasting our time. And by doing this, it's amazing what has happened. The people that are reading the book, it's like their entire team has like leapt upwards in perception. Because the very last chapter of the book is called The Scientific Method. And if you read the book from the beginning to the end, and when you get to the last chapter, The Scientific Method, which when someone just opens it up on the net and reads it, it's mumbo jumbo to most people. I mean, people will read it and they'll go, what does that mean exactly? By the time you get to the end of my book, I have tricked you into learning so much that when you read it, it makes total perfect sense to you. And I tell people, when you first get the book, flip to the last chapter and read The Scientific Method, and then tell me if you get it, and then read the book, and then read the chapter and tell me if you get it. And everyone's like, you know, we didn't get it when we read it the first time. But when we read it the second time, it all fell into place. So I knew I had done my job with the book then.
Right.
As for preparing the reader for understanding really what the scientific method is. A lot of people claim they follow it, but most of these people have no clue what the scientific method means. And you can tell by the way they talk or the way they present their evidence and that sort of thing that they don't. They confuse technology, using technology, with the scientific method, and that is not the case at all. I mean, the scientific method is a protocol. It is a series of steps that you do over and over again exactly the same way so that the data that you mine from that has meaning, has value, can be put into perspective. So the good news is that the people who are reading it and are emailing me and asking me questions, they are kicking it up a notch. One team at a time is kicking it up a notch. And my dream is to have maybe 50 to 60% of the community on board and at least doing part of what I've presented in that book. And I think if that happens, we're going to see a whole lot more in the realm of important discoveries.
That's and of course the I'm sorry, go ahead, David.
No, go ahead. I tend to keep going.
Well, you can tell you're very passionate about what you do, and that's great.
Well, you have to be.
Yeah, exactly.
It can be very dull and boring.
So true. Let me ask you this, because you were just saying how and we were talking about this before you came on, and you were just mentioning it now, how a lot of people are emailing you. They're taking what you're saying, and they're trying it themselves. And you were saying that a bunch of teams have already kind of made this as like, mandatory reading for their teams and stuff. Have you thought of maybe putting together a website where the people who have read your books have tried what you have done, and then they can compile the data in one central location and kind of a main database to kind of see what's happening with your ideas out there?
Well, we actually have a better idea than that.
Okay.
A handful of people. We started on a project a couple of years ago where we wanted to create a professional organization for the paranormal research field. And it's been tried hundreds of times, and it's failed miserably because of egos and all this other stuff, or too many people were involved in the process of creating it and that sort of thing. We started out with 30 people. We ended up with 7 diehard survivors, and we have stuck it out. We have continued to slug through it, and we are hoping sometime next year we will have an organizational website up, and it's going to be for individuals, not for groups. It's going to be like any other professional organization. If you're an engineer or if you're a whatever, you join it. There will be programs within the organization to bring you up to a level if you want to grow. We want to establish peer review, a journal, that sort of thing. We want to be able to publish scientific papers and cross-publish them into applicable disciplines, so that we can entice the scientific community back into this. But part of that project is going to be to develop a user-friendly interface for data storage on a database type of thing. We want to standardize the way it's put in so that it's all relevant and it's easy to search and that sort of thing. So that is part of the project.
Great.
And it will happen down the road. But, we're looking at a year or so before something like that finally comes into being.
Boy, that sounds awesome. I really can't wait to see that happen. It sounds like just what's needed.
Well, it is, because what we want to do is standardize protocols. And and this is the other thing. It's not just scientific. We're opening it up to the metaphysical, too, as well. Because we believe, the core group of researchers who's working on this, we believe that it's very important that we study the metaphysical aspect as well, because we think it's all connected.
Oh, I 100% agree with you.
I have an experiment that we ran on my page with a very famous medium where we monitored the environment when this medium was doing her thing. And every time she began to get information, we were getting a low-frequency carrier wave emerging into the environment.
Wow.
And on that carrier wave was information. You could see that it was like modulated on the carrier wave. It was almost like a different kind of modulation, because it was riding on the actual wave itself. It wasn't like FM or AM. It was a different kind. It was like the information rode on the wave. But as long as that wave was there, she got information. When she stopped getting information, it was because the waveform collapsed. This happened 7 times in a row over the course of the evening. So was it coincidence? It could be, but it's kind of pushing it to be a coincidence.
Right.
So we believe that mediums and psychics actually are receiving a broadcast of some sort, a low-frequency broadcast, that is also emerging into the environment. And they are getting their information directly from that waveform, like a biological television set, for example. They're
right.
Seeing this movie going on in their mind, and they're either a character in it, they're observing it from outside of it, or they're a victim in it, and they are part of this movie going on in their mind. And we believe that it's vital to understand that process, because we think it's connected to the personal experience process that people go through when they experience any kind of paranormal activity, whether it's cryptozoological incident or whether it's a UFO incident or whether it's a ghost incident, we think there's a commonality that's running through all of it. And we
I was just going to say, if you're just joining us this evening here on Taps Family Radio, our guest this evening is David Rowntree. He is the author of Paranormal Technology, Understanding the Science of Ghost Hunting, which is very important. But as David was just saying, it's also it has to, at some point, we have to join hands with the metaphysical world as well, because these two need to come together at some point. And I think that's where we're going to see the big picture. Now, Chris, I know you had a question for David.
I do. Well, I have so many. I don't know where to start. But to follow what you just said, it's amazing the way you said it, when you're talking about how they observed, this flow of information, you observed, frequency changes and things like that. Are you looking at this from a quantum physics viewpoint, maybe they're looking into zero-point field theories and things like that. Are you looking at it from that standpoint, or are you simply right now just trying to record what's going on as people are doing those readings?
No. Actually, we are looking at it from a quantum point of view. We're also looking at it from a standard model point of view. What's really interesting is some of the recent discoveries we've had over the last couple of years where we actually believe that we are dealing with a wormhole type of phenomena, where a wormhole will open, and it's a very localized area of effect.
Right.
Things happen in that wormhole area that kind of bend the laws of physics in our world, and people have these experiences based on their proximity to this wormhole. We believe that explains the emerging EMF, it explains the emerging EVP from that EMF, and it may also explain the connection to the zero-point field, which I have no scientific evidence to back up the next statement I'm going to make. It's a belief. But having read Edgar Cayce at a very early age, he referred to something called the Akashic Record, and I believe that the zero-point field is the Akashic Record. It's like the WWW, World Wide Web of the multiverse.
Yeah, it makes perfect sense, doesn't it?
Yes. Yeah. And all the information that ever was or ever will be is riding in that grid. And what it literally is a lot of people have a hard time putting their mind around grasping it, but the zero-point field is like a huge spidery grid. I mean, think of if you stacked a bunch of screen doors 20 feet tall. Inside of that stack of screens, that's like what the zero-point field was like. And then all of the multiverse, which is our universe, adjacent universes, the whole big pot of stew is inside that grid. So this field transcends space and time. And because of that, it's like the Genesis energy. You know, it's like the energy that was there before, and it's the energy that will be there after. And because of that, I think that it's the grand repository of all information. And what happens is that people get a glimpse of it. They tap into it for whatever reasons. And maybe it's guided by something with greater intelligence than us. Who knows? I mean, that's for philosophical people to deal with and that sort of thing. I can't argue any of that, but the point being is we have discovered what we think is a wormhole phenomena. And there's a whole list of reasons why we think that's what it is. And the reason we think that's what it is, it's the only thing in science, theoretical or otherwise, that would explain the environmental changes that we have documented. What we have noticed is that we are getting time slips, where time is actually changing the rate that it's flowing. We're getting highly ionized areas of air, where the air is just totally, just becomes super ionized. We have bursts of gamma radiation, like occurring in people's living rooms. Well, you know, you don't get bursts of gamma radiation in your living room. We're getting temperature fluctuations. We're getting very localized barometric pressure drops, indicative of a change in the atmospheric pressure. We're getting high levels of static electricity, gravity fluctuations. And all of these things, when you put them all together, there's only one type of theoretical construct that would explain those, and that would be an Einstein-Rosen bridge or a wormhole. Now, the interesting thing about a wormhole is that it could connect two places in space and time, which means it could be connecting an adjacent universe. It could also be connecting an event that occurred in the past to the point where you're seeing that event as it's actually happening, even though it took place 150 years ago. And it's because a wormhole has this thing called a holographic boundary. And it's kind of like, think of it as a big projection screen. So if, let's just say when we, our consciousness is pure energy, all the frequencies that are firing away inside of our body, well, that's energy. And according to the laws of energy conservation, which is a spinoff of the first law of thermodynamics, energy can neither be created nor destroyed. It can be converted, but it can't be created or destroyed. So let's just say when we die, all that energy radiates out of our body. Well, the theory has always been, well, does it stay together as a cohesive unit, or does it just kind of radiate out in all directions? Well, certainly there's a tremendous amount of anecdotal evidence that says it does stay together because of people's experiences and information that we've gleaned from personal experiences. And what started me looking at this in this vein was I read probably 300 or 400 cases of near-death experiences where people had been literally clinically dead for up to 15 or 20 minutes. No brain activity, flatline brain activity. Which kind of eliminates the whole theory of, you know, carbon dioxide induced hallucinations and that sort of thing. And the thing is the same. They go down this long dark tunnel with a bright light at the other end, kind of like what a wormhole would be like. So I got to thinking, what if when we die, a wormhole opens and our consciousness leaves this realm, shifts to a higher frequency, and comes out in a universe adjacent to our own that's based on energy, pure energy, instead of energy and matter. Well, when we arrived there, we could literally create any reality we wanted by manipulating that energy to suit us. So the stories where people are coming and they're seeing all their family, it may be that their family's there as pure energy as well. Is it a far-fetched theory? Maybe, you know. But the important underlying thing here is if we are able to prove that it's a wormhole, forget about what it does for the paranormal. It's a huge discovery in physics. So we're pushing ahead along that vein because we may discover that the study of the paranormal may end up being how we discover the grand theory of everything.
I love that idea.
Oh, my gosh. Wow.
I can't believe I've looked at it that way. What an idea that the light at the end of the tunnel that so many people have talked about could, you know, great theory. Is that the wormhole between our side and their side?
Why has nobody said that before? I mean, that just makes such good sense. Why? I'm amazed. But, you know, David, I was sitting here thinking, I was getting ready to ask you a question, and then you answered it. And so now our producer, Cormac, says you're psychic. But I was going to ask, because we had our academy this weekend, and I was talking about some of this. We were talking about zero-point field, and we were talking about multiverse and all of those things. And one of the guests asked me about time slips. And I really tried to answer it. You said it so much better than I did.
Well, we test it. We test for it. We actually measure it. And people go, how do you measure that, Dave? Oh, my God, how do you measure it? And it's really very simple. And people, if they thought about it, would figure it out. But probably about 10 years ago, I used to hang out at this site that was kind of like a gadget site. You know, like they were always developing different weird electronic things to do. And one of the things was this time slip detector, and the idea behind it was to try to detect torsion fields in physics. And I got to thinking about it. I said, wow, man, that would determine whether you've got something affecting the flow of time. And there's only a few things that could create a torsion field that would do that. So another few years later, this guy who's his name is Jean-Luc Laudon. He's in France. He does a lot of work on alternative energy. He took the circuit and modified it. Essentially, he updated it to modern components and put it on his website. I took it and modified it still more by adding piezo coolers to the two crystal oscillators to keep them temperature constant, to keep any temperature drift from occurring. But essentially what they do is they take two very, very accurate crystal oscillators, either, I can't remember if it was 16 megahertz or 19 megahertz, something like that, and they're like 0.0001% accurate. So they're very accurate. And they beat them against each other, creating a beat frequency. And then they sample the differential from the two frequencies. And in the unit that I built, you know, every two oscillators are slightly different. So you're going to have a slightly different outcome no matter which two you use, as long as they're the same basic oscillator. I ended up with a 700 hertz audio signal as the differential. So we have a speaker on there, and you're hearing the 700 hertz tone just as steady as you please. And it'll play a 700 hertz tone until the battery goes dead. Well, when these things start happening, the tone begins to bend and pitch. And when it does that, the only thing in the mathematical equation that's changing is time. So you know you have a time anomaly. Now, can we tell how much of an anomaly it is? No. Can we tell the difference in the speed? No. All we can do is detect that a time anomaly is occurring. We can't actually measure how much of a time anomaly is occurring. Did we lose 7 seconds? Did we gain 7 seconds? We don't know because we can't measure that aspect of it. But we can measure the fact that it's changed. And that's huge. That's a huge doorway that we just opened up. Because, again, there's only a limited number of things that can affect how time flows. And a wormhole is one of them. And the interesting thing is the wormhole that we're talking about is not a standard wormhole. A wormhole is basically one tube, a big throat, and it only allows one-way travel of information or matter or whatever. What we're looking at doesn't allow matter to travel, but it allows energy to travel in two directions. We think we have essentially a construct that's made up of two quantum vortexes counter-rotating, and they share a common throat. So you end up having an event horizon where all these things occur in a very localized area. And then it goes away. Because what happens is a wormhole needs exotic matter to stabilize, to connect. This exotic matter is matter that has zero or negative mass. When a substantial amount of exotic matter forms, this wormhole connects from wherever it's coming from to where we are. When it connects, immediately that exotic matter begins to annihilate with our own matter. And it annihilates not at an atomic level, but at a subatomic level. We're having particle annihilations. Because if we had atomic annihilations, people would have huge craters in their cities from where these things occurred. It'd be like a nuclear explosion. Yeah. But what's really happening is it's at a subatomic level. And because it's so small, instead of a nuclear explosion, what we're getting is bursts of gamma radiation up to 350 millirads per hour in bursts, just a boom, boom, boom type thing, where these particles are just like being eliminated. Well, once the exotic matter sinks below a certain level, the wormhole is going to collapse and the haunted event ends. And it's like it never was. But it will continue to occur there on a non-predictable basis because that wormhole will keep connecting to that same general area over and over again as the exotic matter builds.
Wow.
And we think that the wormhole is associated with a person's death in that area. And the wormhole originally opens up to admit that person's essence or whatever. And once the connection gets made the first time, there will continue to be a reconnection to that point. Now, whether something uses it or not doesn't make any difference. The connection will still keep being made, but something may not be utilizing it, so we don't know that there's something going on there. And we could literally stand in the middle of the event horizon, and the only thing we would probably feel from it would be like the hair on our arm standing up, maybe a feeling of uncomfortableness, maybe a fear impulse. Based on the neurological stimulus that we would be getting from these different frequencies emerging from it, as well as the elevated static electricity that's being caused by the formation of these wormholes. So we could literally be standing right near the throat of it and never know it was there unless something was going on. We would just get a weird feeling. And how many times have you gotten that kind of feeling? Exactly. And it makes you think about it. You know, yeah. Like, wow.
You make it sound so simple when you say that. And, I mean, it's not a simple...
It's not simple.
But you just, the way you explain it, it's just like, wow. I mean, we're sitting here in our little production chat thing going, wow, we can't believe.
Yeah. Well, I have to explain it that way because it's very important that you understand it coming from your background. Because if I can bring you up to that level that you understand it, you're going to advance yourself and you're going to advance your own knowledge and you're going to take a quantum leap upwards.
Wow.
So by tricking you into learning a little physics, I'm literally like elevating you to your next level so that you can take it and kick it up a notch yourself. And a lot of people are starting to go on college sites and take courses and do stuff because they want to know more. And that's a good thing. That's a very good thing in this field.
Our producer Cormac just said, he says, I'm going to have to go back to this show again, listen to it again to really take all this in. And I think that's fantastic though. I think that's where shows like ours, where they're podcasted and you can go back and download these shows and listen to them over again. This is one, man, that you're going to want to listen to a couple times. Get this on your computer, save it on your hard drive and listen to this and take all this in because the theories are fantastic and just wrapping your brain around them is great. David, unfortunately, we are quickly running out of time here already. We still got about 10 minutes with you. And I mean, I don't even think we've asked any of the questions we've had written down yet. We haven't had to.
All my questions changed.
Well, two things. One is I'll be happy to come back again in the future.
Yes.
The second thing is on my website, I archive all of my shows. So when you get this archived, you send me the link. I put it in my links page. And I have a list for the last several years of radio shows I've done. And a lot of people go there and listen to them. and I also send traffic, of course, to the site that archives it. So
yeah.
I keep those things there just for people to go in and to listen to over and over again. And it also takes traffic from my site and sends it out to the people who are supporting my message. So
I
think that's a very important thing as well. My website also has a research section where we go into, I have my wormhole theory there. I have my theory of the multiverse there. I have papers on, we literally did a study on orbs and found out that, yes, indeed, there really are real orbs. They are cold plasma, and they are products of the wormhole formation. We have measured them. They are very high potential, but very low current. We have the medium experiment. We have a section of experiments where people can really read the paper. They're in PDF format. You can print it out. You can duplicate it. I give you step-by-step instructions on that. So the website is a great resource, and it's www.spininvestigations.org, like SPinvestigations, one word, .org. And I have a Facebook group where it's called Spirit Lab. Yeah, we discuss everything under the sun in there. It's a great place. We've been building and putting pictures up in there as to how we did it. Like one of the members built an orb sucker, kind of like on the grounds of the one that I had built to sample orbs. Yeah, that's what we call it, the orb sucker. Yeah. But he built one that was far more portable because I was using like a small shop vac. He actually used like one of these fans that they use in model jet planes. And it's incredible. I mean, the people are coming up with such great ideas, and we're putting them in there for other people to duplicate and make. So it's a great place to go and hang out. You get into some pretty deep conversations. We discuss the interface between the physical and the metaphysical, how we're studying that. We talk about the consciousness. We talk about technology. Anything you can imagine, we get in there, and everybody weighs in. So it's like a think tank, and it's a great place to hang out. That's in Facebook.
I just sent an ad request, by the way. I just sent to join the group, so I just sent you one.
Great.
I've already been there.
Man, you beat me over there. I'm headed there.
In fact, let me go in there right now, and is that Tim Ellis?
You got it.
Okay, you are now a member.
Yay!
it is a great group. One of the people in there, Anton Ritter, I talked about earlier, he's the one that's developing the digital data logging system right now. So he's a member in there. And we get into some good stuff, and there's a lot of group leaders in there. And it's a great place to come and hang out. And I answer questions. I get probably 300 or 400 emails a day. I get a bunch of messages in Facebook. like I say, it's a good place to hang out, good place to exchange information. And we don't hoard what we know. We share it. Mm-hmm. So if you got questions about anything, drop in and, you know, somebody will get to you. Trust me.
You know, I have got to get your book. I know I've got to get your book. And is there most of what you were talking about tonight in that book, or is there something else that's going to cover part of this?
A lot of everything I've talked about is in the book. However, some of the stuff, the wormhole discoveries was added to it after the first experiment, and it was just thrown into the book. So it's a little out of context, and a lot of people go, oh, man, like you just came out of nowhere with that, and it blew us away. But it's in more detail on my website, because a lot of the discoveries we made were made after the book went to the publisher. So while we do have some of it in there, the website really has the full what we know up to this point. It's more updated than the book was. But you can get a lot of it from the website. The book itself is great because there's a lot of things that aren't in the website that's in the book. Obviously, I couldn't, you know, I had to have something in there so people would buy the book.
Well,
but the foreword is written by psychic medium Jane Doherty. And the afterword is written by my research associate, who's also a critic, John Keegan. John Keegan owns the site Critical Myth. So he actually gets paid to review paranormal shows, which is pretty funny. But anyway, he did the afterwards. I have a podcast that comes out at an irregular basis. It's called The Devil's Advocate, in which we talk about things that you just don't hear on any other broadcast. Most of the time we're looking at individuals and their claims, or we're looking at some specific weirdness that's occurred, or we're talking to a famous researcher like Dr. Michael Persinger, that sort of thing. So it's a lot of information in the podcast. There's no regular schedule. My partner and I, Dr. Stephen Rourke, we put them together as we have time to do it. So it's not like it's comes out on a regular basis. But it's also available in iTunes and stuff like that.
Well, there's nothing regular about the paranormal, so why make it regular for your
That's
your
right. Podcast? Why be normal?
That's
why
right.
Why be normal? But the website's a great resource to go there. And, of course, the Facebook stuff as well is a great place to hang out. So I'm looking forward to seeing you guys dropping in there and participating and hanging out. And like I say, you know, we can you guys can have me back at some point down the road. I'll be happy to come back.
Well, I love that. Yeah.
Consider that done already. we will be getting a hold of you real quick, David, to have you back on again. Real quick, if you can answer this in 3 minutes, maybe you're going to want more time. But it was a question that was brought up to us when you first came on. What do you know about, what is your thoughts on using Faraday cages?
Oh, we've used them a lot. My basement is a large one.
Yeah.
Where my lab is, we use that as for control purposes. But Faraday cages are great because they block out EMF. So obviously, if you use a Faraday cage and you capture an EVP, you've got some proof that EVP is an emerging property. So they're great. They're absolutely great. We have 5 or 6 of them that we've made literally out of bird cages and aluminum screen. They're very cheap to put together.
Mm-hmm.
You can go to the local dump and fish around, and you can find some type of wire pet cage, and you can cover it with aluminum screen and ground it, and you've got an instant Faraday cage. So they're great tools. They're good for doing experimental work. Like if you're trying to determine if you can block out a certain frequency of EMF, you can generate that EMF and put a sensor inside of it and determine if you've blocked it or not. So it's if you do research, you do experiments. And if you do experiments, you have to not only try to prove something's going to happen, but you have to get the proof that it's not going to happen as well. It's a two-way street.
Right.
So these things are very important. It's much like a bell jar in the fact that it gives you an environment to experiment in that is not a normal environment.
All right. Very good. Well, we got that question in, and we're going to have plenty more for you. We'll have you on shortly after the first of the year, so be watching for an email from our booking guy. All right?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Wonderful. He is
pleasure being with you.
Well, the pleasure's been all ours, trust me.
Yeah. I'm just so impressed, and like I said, I cannot wait to get your book. So definitely we're going to have you back. Thank you so much for coming tonight and talking with us about all of this.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me.
You bet. He's David Rowntree. He is the author of Paranormal Technology, Understanding the Science of Ghost Hunting, and My Christmas List just got one item longer tonight. That book is on there. David, have a great night. Thanks for being with us.
Absolutely. You guys too.
All right. There we go. David Rowntree, check the book out. Find him on Facebook. Go to his website, which, by the way, again, real quick, was spininvestigations.org, S-P-I-N. S-P-I-N investigation, spin investigations. I'm sorry, not spin investigations. It's SP investigations. Okay, make that clear. SPinvestigations.org is his website. His book, again, is Paranormal Technology, Understanding the Science of Ghost Hunting. Phenomenal. All right, on that, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, it's time to bring in our mailman, Larry the Mailman, and he's going to have some mailbag questions for us. Coming up, it's Taps Family Radio, live on Jackalope Radio.
Starting out as a paranormal investigator can be very overwhelming. Where to start, who to talk to, how to handle yourself in the field. Until now. Learn from the best. Learn from the official training program of the Atlantic Paranormal Society and the Taps family by attending the Taps Academy. The Taps Academy is a comprehensive one-day informational lecture and investigation training course, all based on a scientific approach to the paranormal. You'll cover paranormal theory, research methods, technology in the paranormal research, and much more. To find out when and where the next Taps Academy will be, or to bring the Taps Academy to your hometown, simply log on to www.tapsacademy.com or phone 401-400-1266. That's 401-400-1266. You have to learn from the best to be the best. And now you can with Taps Academy.
You're listening to Taps Family Radio. Tim and Chris are taking a potty break, and we'll be right back.
Pictures of you that I almost. Coast Paranormal Tours. Dare to explore the unknown.
South Coast Paranormal Tours invites you to explore the haunted decks of the Star of India. We'll show you the paranormal hotspots, then we turn off the lights and let you be a part of your very own paranormal investigation.
Visit us online at scparanormaltours.com.
South Coast Paranormal Tours. Dare to explore the unknown.
When you hear strange noises in the night, when unexplained shadows move through the halls, when you feel there's nowhere you can turn, we're here to help. The Southern Paranormal and Anomaly Research Society. We're a proud TAPS family member with chapters in Mississippi, Georgia, and South Carolina. Our dedicated team of investigators is ready to assist you. With professionalism and the utmost discretion, we'll help you understand what you've been experiencing. The Southern Paranormal and Anomaly Research Society. Because at times like this, you don't simply need proof. You need answers. For more information, visit us on the web at www.spars-paranormal.com.
And good evening, and welcome back to TAPS Family Radio, TFR, and Jackalope Radio on this Tuesday evening. Tim Ellis, Chris Perkins with you, and Chris, what are you doing? The break there,
yeah.
You couldn't even wait for Santa.
Well,
you have your Kindle.
Yeah.
What did you just order?
I could not wait. I'm downloading the Kindle version of that book. I can't wait. I can't help. Santa can bring me the you know, actual 3D version of it. But I have to have it now. I don't want to wait.
That's awesome. Kristen, right now as we speak, is downloading Paranormal Technology, Understanding the Science of Ghost Hunting from David Rowntree, who's our guest. So that's great. And you'll have to let me know how it is. I'm getting it regardless. But I don't do the Kindle thing. See, I'm one of those old fuddy-duddies. I need the book in my hand. And I love reading. And I've got a ton of books. But I haven't moved on to the Kindle yet. I'm just old that way.
Well, you know, you would think it would save me money because they are sometimes a little cheaper. But my problem is when I love a book, I get it on the Kindle and I buy the other copy. So I'm a nerd. I highlight my books.
It's the purpose, doesn't it?
Well, kind of.
Yeah.
Well, you know, but I can take like 50 books on an airplane with me this way, you know, as opposed to like three.
And not to mention, I mean, the ease of it is so fantastic. I mean,
oh, absolutely.
So anyways, we got about 6 minutes left, which means we have to bring in Larry the Mail Guy. Larry, welcome back to TFR, and thank you for bringing the mail, man.
Hey, not a problem. Hey, everybody. So I got a couple questions here from some users. The first one, kind of simple. It says here, if there was one piece of equipment you could take on one investigation, what piece of equipment would it be?
Hmm. I'm going to go with David Rowntree. he would be my piece of equipment. So there you go. That's my answer.
I like your answer. I was going to say audio recorder, but I dumped that for Tim's answer.
So maybe that doesn't quite answer what they're asking for, but if you listen to the show, you'll know exactly what
right.
we're talking about. Yeah.
Which, you know, in my opinion, the digital recorder has got to be like, you know, the one piece that I think any paranormal investigator would take with them.
Yeah, I would agree. If being in all seriousness, you know, go back to the days of Hans Holzer. Hans always said, all you need is, back in those days, he just had the big, you know, portable audio recorder, but he said, all you need is a good audio recorder and a good psychic. Give me a good audio recorder any day.
Moving on to our next question here. It says here, what kind of trigger objects have you guys used during investigations, and what was the outcome?
You know, this weekend, several were used. You know, the people listening tonight, our guests tonight, have probably heard when we were talking about the bowling ball and the toys at St. Albans. And so sometimes we try to make them specific to the situation. if we know the situation, such as a child being there. But one thing that I like that we usually try to bring along is a ping pong ball. And as basic as it sounds, it's easy to move. We can either draw a circle around it, put it on the edge of a table, or something like that, just to give them something to possibly move.
We have in the past, one place we investigated, actually TAPS was there. It was Mission Point Resort on Mackinac Island up here in Michigan. And about a month and a half after TAPS was there, we were granted permission to go in. There's a great haunted theater there that is supposed to be haunted by a young girl. We brought a couple dolls, put them up in the balcony area where she's been seen. And we actually got a couple interesting pictures using the full spectrum still cam. Where it almost looks like you can see what looks to be a small figure near the dolls up in the balcony. And we actually just did an investigation this past weekend at an old hospital. It was a TB hospital and then a sanitarium later in its life. And we actually brought some doctor's equipment, some crutches, some lab coats and stuff like that. And we used those as kind of trigger objects this past weekend as well. So I love trigger objects. I love bringing them. I love using them. I'm a big proponent of them. And how about you, Larry?
I've kind of the same thing Chris was talking about. You know, we've used ping pong balls. We've used toys for, you know, the different claims of, you know, a child or something like that. And I'll tell you, we've came up with some good audio. And the trigger objects have moved. We have that on camera as well. I think it's a good thing to explore when investigating. You know, you never know what's going to happen. So
exactly, I really like bringing them along. Well, there we go. Thank you. The first real incarnation of Larry the Mail Guy. Like I said, we don't have Larry the Cable Guy. We have Larry the Mail Guy here on TFR. So. We're very excited to be bringing Larry in each show to bring us our mail questions. Real quick, what's the email they can send them to give you a mailbag question, Larry?
I'm actually going to be creating a new one. Okay. So you can send them to tfradiomailguy@gmail.com.
Love it. tfradiomailguy@gmail.com. Yeah. If you have any questions, send them to Larry the Mail Guy. We have less than a minute to go. Our show in 2 weeks, which will be November 29th, we have author and host of 30-odd Minutes, Jeff Belanger, great guy, fantastic author. He will be with us in 2 weeks live here on TFR. Next time we talk, it will already have been past the American Thanksgiving, so happy Turkey Day to all of the American listeners out there. Have a great night, my friends. This is TFR live on Jackalope Radio. Have a great night.
Been listening to TAPS Family Radio, the safest place in the paranormal world. Join us every Tuesday evening at 6 p.m. Eastern, 5 Central, 4 Mountain, and 3 Pacific on the new home for TAPS Family Radio, Jackalope Radio.